Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the third program of the Heretics Hour with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I'm going to talk about World War II history, and for that, I am extremely proud to have with me a distinguished guest who not only personally lived through the prelude and the aftermath of World War II in Austria and Germany, but was a pilot for the German Luftwaffe for the entire duration of the war. My guest is Dr. Wilhelm L. Fissmann. Dr. Fissmann, thank you so much for agreeing to discuss your personal wartime experiences with me tonight. I know it's going to be a fascinating program.
Well, thank you for having me on your radio show. Welcome, and I'm ready for all your questions. I'm ready to talk to you.
Thank you. All right. Well, Dr. Fissmann, I have read your autobiography, and I have looked at web pages that others have put up about you. And these pages will be given on the program page after this show for others to go to and read about you. So we won't need to go into all the details of your life, which are quite extensive. But your accomplishments are many, and you have lived a long life. Tonight, we're just going to talked about the World War II period, and even at that, we'll have to skim over quite a bit, so I apologize for that in advance. I'd like to begin with the lead-up to the war. You were born in October 1919, and so were a schoolboy during the highly eventful years of the 1920s and 30s, which saw the rise of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism, along with the inauguration of the Third Reich and its very successful and promising early years. Can you describe those years for us from your perspective at that time and that of your family?
Well, I would like to do it, and before I do it, I think as a kind of a background, I want to let you and your listeners know the situation of Austria as a newly found republic in 1919. After the end of World War I, 1918, the land was cut off of the huge Austrian-Hungarian Empire, a rump state of 6.5 million people, 90% of them ethnic German talking people belonging to the large German cultural family. The economic situation was very severe because it was cut off of the big Austrian-Hungarian Empire, deprived of the supply of foodstuff and oversized in certain industries, depending on import of foodstuff and depending on export of their heavy textile, paper and lumber industry. Politically, it was, there were three or four parties in the parliament of the Austrian Republic at that time. And very early, very interesting, early 1919, the official government wanted to join Germany as the 3.5 million Germans in Bohemia did in two provinces of Austria. There was already at that time a vote of joining Germany, but the Treaty of Versailles and the Treaty of Saint-Germain forbid it. And so Austria had to go along as an independent republic. All the years from 1919 to when I was 10, 11 years old, there were four parties controlling the political life in Austria. A left-wing party, the Social Democrat, about 30-40% of the people. The center party of the Christian Socialists, And then some center of the right party, splitter parties, three of them. And they were responsible for the political changeovers in the Republic. So the family, my father was a teacher in a small village in southern part of Austria, Carinthia. The country, the province at that time was fighting even in 1919 against the Slovenian-Yugoslavian onslaught that tried to occupy and part of the southern province of Austria. So there was another year of war fight, and finally in 1920 we regained our freedom as an independent province of the Republic of Austria. That was the situation all the way up to the early 1930s. The government, ruling government in Austria, was a coalition government of the center party of the Christian Socialists and some splitter party of the right. But the strong Social Democrat Party was in the minority, and there was restlessness amongst the people. It was they called them at the time Austromazis, the radical left party, and people were very unhappy, and so early 1932-33, as a matter of fact, the coalition government dissolved itself by a parliamentarian dictate and became kind of a non-democratic government, kind of dictatorship under a new constitution, which was based on a papal clerical government institution, the so-called papal encyclic. And,
right. This is what was termed the blacks, the clerical party, and
the influence of a clerical party in
the Roman Catholic Church was
Catholic Church,
behind that. Okay. And so, go ahead.
All the parties existing at that time were illegal, and the country was ruled, as I said, by the dictatorship, kind of a dictatorship by the black clerical party and Social Democrat. The right of the center parties were in the underground, and the politics of the government were supported primarily by Italian fascist government of Mussolini. That was kind of a very strange situation, because Italy was in the country itself by the common people not liked too much. So
I ask you what happened in Austria when Adolf Hitler took power in Germany? Was the reaction?
Well before 1938 there was a revolt and a putsch in 1934 in February by the leftist Social Democrats, bloody upheaval for about a week, bloody fighting in Vienna, and over 100 people were killed. And shortly afterwards, in July 1934, the National Socialists put a putsch on there. The offices of the Federal Chancellery were occupied by a special commando troop in the uniform of Austrian police. There was a short exchange of hand fire, and the federal chancellor was fatally wounded and died there, and the revolt was turned down there, and illegal activities underground continued.
Oh, what was your reaction to all this as
well,
a boy whose father was a teacher?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was attending the high school gymnasium, and we were under control of the government too. What we were thinking, nobody knew, but activities underground continued. We were meeting in circles, we were talking specifically after Hitler's takeover in Germany. We looked over the border and admired what's going on there, specifically the 1936 the Olympic Games had a big impression in our country.
Yes. Well, okay, we're going to have to jump forward a little bit. How did you become a member of the Luftwaffe, and can you tell us about your experiences there? Somewhat briefly, please.
Well, after graduation in June 1938, I was drafted into the German forces. I didn't know which branch it was, but I ended up at an airfield in Lower Bavaria, and had to attend the first 6 months at the boot camp, and then in April 39 I started flying at the flying school.
Okay, and that led you to become a bomber pilot.
Well, it took 1.5 years schooling, starting with small planes, then multi-engine planes. And in September 1940, I finished then the final school of blind flying and instrument flying, and ended up at a bomber group in West Germany, September 1940, readied for the Battle of Britain. But by that time, more or less, the battle was over. There were plenty of schools, but no airplanes, and I was transferred then to a special unit in Berlin, flying targets for the anti-aircraft forces there.
Okay, and then eventually you were sent to the Eastern Front.
Eventually, yes, after different services in Berlin and later in West Germany. In September 1942, I was transferred to a bombing group in northeastern Russia, south of Leningrad, and flew missions at an area primarily supporting the fighting divisions on the ground, northeast Russia.
Okay, this was south of Leningrad?
No, south of Leningrad, between the Valdai area, Valdai Heights, and around the Lake Ladoga, Volhov, and the Ilmen Lake. Flew about 90 missions there, and in 1943, in June, we were transferred to the middle section of Russia, and I flew then a few missions in the famous Battle of Kursk-Orel under the code name of Citadelle. It was shot down on July the 5th, 1943, and was lucky to crash land and survive with my crew, and was saved by a German tank, and flew a few days later my last mission in Russia, and was transferred back to Germany and sent for a short vacation back home.
Yes, and before we close down this chapter, I want to point out that I've been studying up on you, And you are a modest man, so I want to tell the audience that on January 11th, 1943, you were ordered, there was an emergency mission ordered by your wing commander, Colonel Wilkie, and it was for the citadel of which is in that area that we were talking about. And this was a citadel where 7,000 German troops were encircled and cut off, but they were still holding a vitally important road crossing. And the fuel, their problem, one of their main problems, well, of course, they needed all their supplies airlifted or airdropped into them. And fuel was one of their biggest problems. And so some fuel had to be delivered and dropped by parachute, and you were, at this point, one of the three crews that got the order to do this rather dangerous flight because there was a tremendous amount of anti-aircraft firing going on by the other side. So, and your crew was particularly successful, and I believe one of the three crews was lost. Is that right?
Yeah, we were three crews left at night. It was a night mission and very risky because we had to release our fuel containers with a parachute, and it was within a certain height it had to be released in order to drop into the center. And well, out of the three planes, Lieutenant Koenig, he apparently was shot down, and two of us came safely back and got shortly afterwards the result that the canisters landed there and had out the tanks, which were without fuel at that time. Yes,
it's a very dramatic story. And then on January 20th, you received the Iron Cross First Class, you and your crew, from the commanding general Ritter von Greim, who is well known also. You might want to say a few words about him.
Well, I didn't meet him personally, naturally, but he signed the papers and the documents for the reward of the Iron Cross First Class. As I said, I never met him before because I never met him at all.
Mm-hmm. But you had gotten the Iron Cross Second Class previous to this, isn't that right?
Yeah, that was after my first 50 missions. The whole crew got the Iron Cross Second Class, yes. I forgot to mention that I lost on one of the attacks in Wolhofstroy. My wireless operator was hit by a shell of the Russian anti-aircraft batteries concentrated about that area. But we were lucky again, and we were supported by German fighters and landed safely back at our airfield near Pskov.
So you flew 93 missions altogether on the Eastern Front.
Yes, 93 missions, and then was sent back to my France in July, it was early August, to Orléans-Brissy in France for refreshment, recourses, retraining. And in October, I joined again my group in the southern part of Russia. By that time, I developed a strange sickness in my eyes, night blindness, and couldn't fly at night and again. So after being in charge of ferrying airplanes from the factory in Germany back to our group, I was released, and I had to join the ferry pilots in a German aircraft factory. And from then, that was in 44, April, May 44, from that time on, I was flying, picking up aircraft from the air plants and air factories and delivering them to different bomber groups and fighting groups, and flew quite a bit of different airplanes. And towards the end of 44, the German jet bomber, rather 234, which I delivered then all the way until late April, early May 1945, when I ended up at an airfield near Flensburg on the Danish border, and the war ended there on May 4th, 1945.
So you were one of the first first pilots to actually fly the new German jet airplane.
Well, there was a whole group already missions in the Rada 234 was not the first jet. There were already Messerschmitt jets in fighter pilots in action, but there were all in all about, I guess, about a little bit over 200 Arada 234s built, and as I said, one group was already flying missions with the 234.
Okay, thank you for that. That's very interesting, very, very interesting information. Before the break, I'd like to ask you about what you ever heard or knew about concentration camps, and what kind of knowledge, as far as you know, was about brutality by Germans against POWs or civilians or any of those issues while you were serving?
Well, already very early in 1938, after the Anschluss, the mayor of our village was a Social Democrat, and also the commander of this militant union of the Social Democrat Republikanische Schutzbund, they call it, and he was put under custody, and we knew that he ended up in Dachau. That was early May 1938, and he returned in June 1938. I didn't talk to him personally, but his daughter went together in school with me, and she told me that her father returned. He was interviewed. They found out that he didn't commit anything, and that he was apparently treated all right, because when he came back, he naturally wasn't the mayor anymore, but he was continued working in the factory there. So that was the only knowledge about a concentration camp I had all the way through all the years from 38 to the end of the war, 1945. And only after the war, the first messages and pictures and horrible stories were public.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever witness any brutality by your fellow Wehrmacht or by any other German forces, or did you ever see the SS in action, or were you
As a pilot for all the years, we were, first of all, in Russia, we were amongst ourselves, and during my month as a ferrying pilot, I was very busy picking up the planes, flying the planes, returning at the trains back to my apartment in Berlin and in Bernburg. No, I have never any caught. I never heard anything about concentration camps or brutalities in. And during my Berlin stay, I mean, I had contacts with the people living in Berlin, and I lived with them and lived under the severe air attacks towards the late in 44, but never. I was hearing any horrible stories about concentration camps or brutalities against people.
What kind of feelings of patriotism did you and your comrades have? You know, were there any doubts about what you were doing? I think you really probably already answered that, but just to...
No,
if
you were...
You understand what I'm saying.
You were soldiers under oath, and we knew that it was a vital fight. I mean, that we not only fought for Germany, but for Europe and against the brutal onslaught of communists against us, and that was our duty, and we fulfilled our duty as soldiers who swore the oath to our military and political leaders.
Well, thank you very much. It's time for the break. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not over yet. This is just our news break. So please stay with us, and we'll return back in a few minutes. Thank you.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, as Lithuania marked the 20th anniversary of its independence, the celebrations were marred by the country's grim economic situation. RT's Igor Ogrodnev went to see how the first country to leave the USSR is coping with the deepest recession in decades.
Like many others, Edmundas and Galina have resorted to keeping animals and poultry to support themselves through Lithuania's severe economic crisis. Edmundas suffers from serious heart problems, but his disability benefit was cut and comes in at only 200 euros a month. He has to keep a side job simply to feed his family.
To receive that check with less money was unpleasant. What we are doing is very wrong. We're cutting spending on everything, but the rich people will be all right, whatever happens.
The slogans call for the heads of their government. The country has been celebrating the 20-year anniversary of its declaration of independence from the USSR. But these citizens are using the occasion to show their displeasure with new Lithuania.
We've had 20 years of independence, but we have not achieved the things we wanted and dreamed of.
The economy shrunk by over 10% in 2009, one of the worst figures in Europe, and is set to barely grow this year. The government's responded by slashing benefits and pensions.
Those least responsible for the crisis are paying the highest price. Apart from Latvia, and now Greece, we are the only European country that has gone ahead with such unprecedented measures.
Lithuania is also in an energy bind. Ignalina's nuclear power plant used to produce enough electricity for the whole of Lithuania. The EU forced its shutdown at the end of last year. Utilities and electricity prices continue to spiral. And young people are still leaving the country in droves to seek employment in Western Europe. It will take Lithuania years to recover from the effects of the economic crisis. And until it does, such demonstrations will continue, and any celebration will be bittersweet. Igor Gorodnev, RT, Vilnius, Lithuania.
Well, Lithuania isn't the only European country currently experiencing tough financial difficulties, with Greece and Latvia also struggling to keep their economies afloat. But as European parliamentarian Giulietto Chiesa says, the source of these problems lies not only with Europe, but across the Atlantic.
It is one of the worst situations in Europe now, along with the other Baltic states. Everybody is there, is not in a very good shape. It seems that all the process of gaining real independence has been...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm talking with my distinguished guest, Dr. Wilhelm Christmann, who served as a Luftwaffe pilot from 1938 until 1945. Dr. Christman has been giving us a real deal from the Wehrmacht soldier's point of view. Dr. Christman, the last months of the war were particularly terrible, and I'm sure very sad for warriors like you who have given so much to the war effort. What can you tell us of what you saw and felt and what you were doing during these months?
Well, I was, as I mentioned, ferrying aircraft, picking new aircraft from the aircraft factories and delivering them to the different fighting units. But I was stationed and lived, had a small apartment in Berlin. That was January, February 1945, returning always to my apartment, and 40 days of this period of January, February, there were nightly attacks by mosquitoes dropping so-called aerial mines over the city. Destructive, very destructive. I think early February my apartment was hit by one of those aerial mines. We were in the Luftschutzkeller, where that's the center of underground protection rooms for the ministry of Goering's ministry. So we were feeling the tremendous detonations, but only the destructive was then seen after attacks. And Berlin at that time was already heavily destroyed, but the spirit of the people were more or less unbroken. I mean, there were terrible situations, but the food supply, the supply of clothing and sanitary supply, everything was more or less in order. I had tremendous experiences on my railway trips back to Berlin. I mean, sometimes we had to stop in front, I remember, in front of the railway station of Nuremberg, because Nuremberg was exploded. But luckily enough, in early March, I was transferred to an airfield near Burg, which is west of Berlin, and stayed from there on at that place, and ended up on May 1st in at the airfield on the Danish border near Lech, and this is where the war ended and where the airfield was taken over by a Canadian tank division, and we were in a tent camp at the edge of the airfield, and so-called surrendered person and organized by the German officers, a regiment or division. There were hundreds of thousands of German surrendered persons between the Baltic Sea and North Sea and the Danish border and the canal crisscrossing from West Germany to Berlin. It was occupied and controlled by the British forces. But the daily life was more or less still under former Wehrmacht officers, and we had our daily roll calls, we had our lots of sport events, until after two or three weeks we Austrians were separated to a special camp on the beaches of the North Sea near the town of Husum, and waiting for our release to Austria. That was not only weeks, but months. And early September, there was the rumor that the Austrian surrendered personnel will be moved to the Volkswagen area, or the factory to Volkswagen, to clean up the rubble there. So three of my friends decided that was long enough that we stayed here, so we left our camp with the truck until we ran out of gasoline and boarded then the trains. And the train, a coal train from near Frankfurt, Offenbach to Munich. And to Munich we were stopped by a military police, and he checked out our wanted to know if we have any papers.
This was a British military police or what?
No, that was American zone. You know.
Okay. All right.
Bavaria was in the American zone, and I had only my identification papers as a pilot of the Junkerswerke. But he was happy with them. I mean, released us, had no more trouble, and we had then to switch from the American zone into Austria, the German American zone, Bavaria, into the province of Salzburg, Austria, which, since we didn't have any papers, we crossed the Salzach River at night, and from there I boarded with my friend Hoffmann a truck all the way up to the border of Salzburg and Carinthia. Carinthia was in the English zone, Salzburg was in the American zone, and we were warned if we don't have any papers, we will be arrested by the British soldiers at the border station in Carinthia. So we were hiding in the locomotive and...
The locomotive? You were hiding in a locomotive?
Yes. Well, we talked to the engineer there and he let us hide there so that the controlling English soldiers didn't find us. And when the train stopped after went through the large tunnel on the other side, the engine drove all the quarter of a mile beyond the railway station, and we two left unmolested and unchecked the railway station of Malnitz.
Okay, and so how close to home were you now? Were you then?
Well, we stayed overnight in a farmhouse, and then started walking down the road.
And what was the farm? Was this a farmhouse that a friend?
Oh, 60 miles still from home.
On okay. Went up to this farmhouse and they let you stay there. Is that what happened?
Yes, the wife. The lady of the farm lady there, she was very nice to us. She gave us some hot milk. We were sleeping in the haystack there in the barn. And in the morning we left and started walking. And after a few kilometers, car stopped us. It was a German officer and still in his uniform without the swastika, naturally. And he was, as we found out, in the service of the English occupying powers there, and asked us where we want to go, took us then all the way to Klagenfurt, where my friend was stationed, where he left. We said goodbye to each other, wished our luck, and I was the fellow then, the car driver still drove me all the way down to the valley, which was a special zone, and you could cross the river Drau only with special, as I found out, with a special pass, which naturally I didn't have, so I had to stop there. And it was a farmhouse inn, and there was a young girl there, and I asked her, well, if she could help me there. She said, well, you might talk to the commander of the British company there guarding the bridge, and she did that, and she said, well, this is a native of the village across in the valley, would he let him go? And well, after a short interview, finding out who it was, he let me go, and I crossed without any special passport the bridge. It was already dark in the evening. As I said, it was September, early September. And I started walking, and on my walk back to my home village, again a car stopped, asked me where I was heading for, and I told the gentleman who I was and who I was heading. It turned out it was the mayor, the newly elected mayor of Feistritz, and he took me, delivered me at the schoolhouse, and well, I entered our apartment up there and met my mother and my sister, and they fell to the floor when I entered, and we were starting crying and falling into each other's arms, and it was very dramatic. I found out that my father wasn't home, my sister wasn't home, and well, I stayed 2 days there. Then I went to the mayor's office, asked for food stamps, and registered there, and everything was in order. I had no problems there. 2 days later, the inspector of the gendarmerie, which is the local police, came to our home and said, well, Willie was very friendly because he knew our family. You have to come with me because the British wanted to talk to you. There's a jeep there from the front secret service. You better take some, he was kidding, take some toothbrush and a towel with me. Well, I knew there was something cooking up for me, so I took more than the toothbrush with me and boarded the jeep. They took me to down down there.
I know, Dr. Kreisman, I'm going to interrupt here because we're getting short of time. And I know that your story on why you, how you were put into the camp is very dramatic. Maybe we'll save that for another time, because I would like you to tell us about the camp that you were put in and how you found your father there.
Well, I had an interview with, as it turned out, a Viennese Jewish man in the uniform of a British Secret Service, and he accused me that I was not a prisoner or a surrendered person, but I was in the underground as a werewolf. And I got excited naturally too, and still a little cocky. So I ended up in a camp, in first in Wolfsburg and then Betzendorf, where there were, in the camp of Wolfsburg, there were about 4,000 people interned, well, from Feldmarschall Kesselring all to the former governor of Carinthia, professors of university, generals, political party, big wigs, and
and this camp was run by who?
This camp was run by the British. It was in the British zone. I mean, it was the guards were Irish soldiers, but in British uniforms. The camp commander was a colonel who was formerly in charge of some garrisons in India. And I spent there all the way from September 45 to in Wolfsburg until early, spring 1946. And then I was transferred to another camp in near Graz in Styria, still under British, in the British zone. And never interviewed. We were working for the British occupation zones in troops in Styria. And I was released without any further questions in early spring 1947.
And would you say that you were doing forced labor while you were there?
Well, we were in Wolfsburg. We were lumberjacking. I mean, we're working as lumberjacks. If we could work in Wolfsburg, in at the camp in Betzendorf, we were working in a open pit coal mine, and then at the airport in Dahlerhof, The Brits were all their supplies moving from Italy to this airfield in Styria, and we were working there during the day from the morning until late afternoon.
Did you ever get paid for any of this labor that you performed?
No, no pay. No,
no, nothing.
No, huh? No pay. No.
Okay. And you found your father there, right?
My father was imprisoned in Wolfsburg. Yes, he was not in when I was transferred to Graz. My father was still imprisoned in the camp in Wolfsburg and released half a year later for, well, he was in our town of Freistetz in Rosenthal, 2,000 people. He was during the Hitler time in the kept the files of the Ortsgruppe, and it was primarily work of not party work, but for the administration of the city towns. And then they, I think he was imprisoned because of his German efforts fighting against the Slovenian influence in the village headed by the Catholic priest, and made enemies in the Slovenian minority, and one of the Tito partisans went to the Brits and told him, well, this teacher here was suppressing us and was not nice to us. He was preaching against the Slovenian minorities, and I think that was the major reason why they arrested him, and he was reinstated then in early 48 and became got his job as a principal of high school back again, and had no further problems.
What was the effect of the war crimes trials? When you were in the camp while they were going on, I take it, did it make a very big impact, or was it sort of something that people weren't that aware of?
Well, they were naturally aware, but it was the impression of many, what did you expect from the victors? It was the revenge of the victors, and responsibility lay within it was a terrible situation, but the reaction of the common people was just, they had to take it as it happened.
So there wasn't a lot of belief put into it. It was like, well, this is the victors, this is victors' justice, and there's nothing we can do about it. They just accepted it.
That was primarily the reaction of the people, yes.
What was there any denazification program that you went through, or was going on?
You know, I was not a member of the party, because you had to be, first of all, the members of the forces, of the German forces, were not allowed to be member of the party. Secondly, I was not, I was under 21 years old, but my father was a member of the party, and he went through the denazification process. Yes, it was a long drawn, very interesting, that it was well supportive by the government in our province of Carinthia was a social democratic party, but quite different from the radical social democrats in the late 20s and early 30s. That was the funny thing is, the governor of the province of Kärnten at that time, that means in 48, 49 and earlier, was a former Hitler Youth League turned social democrat, and they were very helpful in getting the common members of the party back into the daily ordinary life. So it was handled, I would say, very fairly, and with the exception of the big wigs, the common members were declassified in an orderly way.
Very interesting. Do you, how would you, can you say in just a few words what would be the difference between what Austria experienced after the end of the war and what Germany experienced, what the Germans up in Germany experienced?
Well, we were, like Germany, occupied by the four allies. There were four zones, the French in the west, provinces of Vorarlberg and Tyrol, the American zone, Salzburg and Upper Austria, the Russian zone, Lower Austria, Burgenland and Vienna, and the English zone, Carinthia and Styria. And Vienna was occupied by all four zones, and the British zone was, the administration was lenient, it was no problems. The real danger, the real trouble started in the Russian zone. They demanded all the industrial scenes and industrial factories, removed all the equipment, controlled the traffic in the lower country, and I think the same thing happened in Germany between what happened in East Germany under the communist government and the Russian occupying zone was pretty similar what happened in the eastern zone in Austria. And
The Allied zone, the Western zones in Germany, the people were treated quite badly in many ways and in many areas. I'm wondering if that wasn't. I don't think the Austrians were treated as badly as the Germans were treated.
Well, not. You mean after?
After the war,
they actually arrested. All the inhabitants of the camp in Wolfsburg and in Graz. There were similar camps in Salzburg and in the western provinces. But once the common people were not treated poorly. There was still shortage of food supply and fuel. There were still for quite a few years food stamps and problems with railway connections. But otherwise, I think. At least
we know the stories that the Germans were starved for a couple of years after the war in large measure, but I don't think that was taking place where you were, right?
Well, as I said, the food situation was tense, and we had food stamps. All the way to, I left Austria in 1953, but all the years up to 1953, we had enough to eat. We didn't starve to death. And that went across the whole country.
Well, Dr. Kreisman, thank you very much. We're going to have to close now, I'm sorry to say. And it's been a very enlightening discussion. There's much that we missed, and so I hope you'll be willing to come on another time so we can learn more about your most interesting life and your viewpoint, your original viewpoint that is rare today.
Well, I thank you for having me at your radio show. Whenever you think you would like to have me, I'm willing to talk to you again, and thank you again.
Well, thank you very much. You're quite a gentleman. This has been wonderful. So that's it for tonight, friends. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour, and I may have another guest next week. So please stay tuned and keep your eye out for what's coming up on Monday night's Heretics Hour on VOR. Thank you and good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com.